This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun.
This is a sort of informal, looser version of a talk that I gave at IndieCade two, 3 weeks ago. I think it went over really well, and I got a lot of good feedback and talked to a lot of cool people. The talk is called Single Player Competition: Building Strong Strategy Game Systems That You Can Live In. It starts off by talking about how I'm a strategy game designer. I design competitive games about mastery with distinct enforceable goals, games that are deep, replayable is one way it's described. These are games that are disciplines. They're part of your life and they're part of your identity. So these games, unlike, you know, a Portal, for example, or even a Final Fantasy, they're not things that you sort of like play and you beat and you put it away. Maybe someday you come back to it and play it and beat it again or whatever. They're not these like contained experiences, but they're more like, you know, I speak French, I fence, I like to garden. I like to cook. They're disciplines. I play the guitar. Those kind of things. So these are games that become disciplines. They become part of your identity. You are a StarCraft player, etc. They're games like, you know, StarCraft, Counter-Strike, Smash Brothers, Total War, you know, lots of war games. Most board games fall into this category, particularly like Euro board games or abstract board games. They're very much skill-based and mastery-based. So that's the kind of system that I want to make. But beyond that, recently especially, my goal is to make what I call strategy games that you can live in. And that means three things. I have these three criteria for what that means. One is that they're sort of comfortable, acceptable, they're modern. So they sort of go down smooth. When people see them, alienated, they don't feel like, what is this weird thing? What is this weird machine? They get it. It exists within the current landscape of video games in a way that people understand. And this is an important, this might sound kind of obvious to most people, but actually for someone like me, it's the least obvious of these points. And it's something that I have to keep in mind, and it does come back later on as a constricting factor. So let's keep that in mind. Point one, comfortable and acceptable, modern. Speaks to the current language is a good way to do it, to talk about that. So I also want games that are deep. These are deep, strong systems. They're deep enough to endure the rigorous testing that they get when thousands of players play them every day for years. Sometimes this is called like evergreen, a system. Again, this goes back to like replayability, avoiding solution, avoiding or, you know, reducing the ability of players to develop dominant strategies, having a wide and a range of kinds of possible valid moves, and those sort of things. So point two is deep depth. And this has really been my main concern, generally speaking, in my time as a game design writer, has been concerned with how do we make games that are deeper and more interesting by the interactive merit that they have, not by their theme or by their story or by their characters or anything like that. Just literally, you know, their interaction itself is interesting, and that goes to this idea of depth. And you can learn more about that from my other videos and my definitely watch 3-Minute Game Design, and, you know, I've written books about this. And then the third point, which is kind of the new addition, which is this idea of making games that are welcoming, compassionate, and responsible, socially responsible. And we'll talk about that a little bit in this video. This is something that I haven't really concerned myself with too much in past games, but going forward, I really value it a lot more. So I want games, and I'm going to talk about this a bunch, but I want games that don't feel hostile, that don't feel unwelcoming or exclusionary, and games that don't feel aggressive or you know, hostile is the best way to put it. And over the past few years, I've become increasingly aware of my social responsibility as a creator. I don't want to make games that contribute to, you know, any kind of racism, sexism, ableism, or any other types of exclusionary social forces. And I also don't want to make games that contribute to an atmosphere of hostility or toxicity, or that are anti-compassion training simulators of any kind. I want to make games that are welcoming to people and that don't perpetuate bad ideas or bad patterns of behavior. And like, the thing is, avoiding this stuff is really difficult because it's so woven into the fabric of our society. It's the water that we've just always been swimming in. But there are some specific ways that it's even harder for strategy game designers. So it's hard for anyone making any media because we all grow up in this world where we make these things that are exclusionary, that are racist and that are sexist and all this stuff. And so it's hard for us to just turn around and like produce something that's not like that. But it's even harder, I think, for strategy game designers. And I'm going to talk about why that is. That's what this talk is really all about. How do I make deep, endlessly replayable strategy video games that people will like and feel comfortable with and then speak the language of video games, but that also are as non-toxic as possible? Ideally, all else being equal, it would be really great if we could make strategy games that made people, to the extent that games have any impact over people, better rather than worse. So what are the challenges and what are some solutions? Strategy games. When I say strategy games, I mean something a little bit different than the genre as it's listed on Steam or something like that. I specifically mean contests of decision making. So these are systems wherein you're pursuing a binary goal and making decisions that reflect your understanding of that system. A series of decisions that function as a kind of limited test of your understanding of that system. So it's distinct from something like puzzles in that you're not trying to find a solution. You're just trying to find a series of moves that will demonstrate a certain level of understanding. So if you do, you win, and if not, you lose. So that winning binary goal sort of component is pretty fundamental to this kind of system that I'm talking about, that I'm interested in making and pursuing. Strategy games are really cool because ideally you can just sort of make this little engine once and it produces funds for years and years and years. I can't tell you how many hours I've sunk into Tropic Euro, a free Java applet version of the board game Puerto Rico. This thing has no sound and barely anything that should be called graphics, and yet here I am playing it over and over again. And the reason is that it has a strong rule set. It's got depth. This is the goal of a good strategy game design, to create a machine that continues to deliver interesting situations, challenges, and plainly fun long after it's released. Now that turns out to be kind of a double-edged sword for strategy games though, because this means that they're very, very difficult to design. You know, with something like puzzles or, you know, interactive, other kinds of interactive systems, a lot of times you know, they only need to be interesting for so long. And so the system doesn't need to be quite as robust. One of the reasons that strategy games require this robustness is that people are just very smart. They're very good at figuring things out. They're very good at finding dominant strategies, all those kinds of things. So your game has to be pretty complicated, really, to avoid that. While there are simple strategy games that at least seem to work, I'm not satisfied with them. For example, it's possible to take a very simple, solved game, something like tic-tac-toe, and make it sort of seem not solved, by having it played on a large board outdoors, wherein players throw rings or other objects to play their moves. This kind of thing, while it does create variant outcomes and arguably increases some form of depth, it does not increase the strategic depth of tic-tac-toe. So a good move in tic-tac-toe is still a good move, regardless of whether you missed the good move. To a lesser degree, many strategy video games do something exactly or very similar to this. They just aren't as deep as they appear, and they use these kinds of techniques, randomness, execution, in order to add noise to an otherwise pretty solved system, or easily solvable system. Another common method is to use lots of output randomness or unfair input randomness in a shallow game to create variant outcomes. So in tic-tac-toe, the output randomness variant would be flip a coin every time you want to mark a square, and if it's tails, the square doesn't get marked. The unfair input randomness variant would be something like players draw cards marked 1 to 9 through the game, and they can only play spaces of the cards that they have. So, you know, the spaces are numbered like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and you draw these cards, and if you have a 5, you can play the one in the middle, and so on. Some matches, they're just going to luck out. Like, oh, wow, I have the card that I need to play. Other matches, not so much. In real games, I should just mention that we usually see output randomness in the form of like two hit dice rolls, kind of like D&D combat style stuff. XCOM also has that. And input randomness would be something more like map generation, something that you can see before you make decisions. And here's a chart that sort of demonstrates these the relationship between the player decision, the random effect, and how it's processed for both output randomness and input randomness. And I should mention again that I have videos on this in 3-Minute Game Design, which you should check out. True strategic depth can only come from one place, though. That's complexity of the strategy system itself. You can mitigate this problem somewhat by relying on emergent complexity, complexity that emerges as a result of the rules in action. But in my experience, most deep strategy games need a lot of inherent complexity. That means actual game rules, like unit types, special abilities, etc. as well. So, okay, switching gears for a moment, let's talk a little bit about how we can make games that are more welcoming to everybody, and maybe even have a slightly positive effect on society. So games as a type of media contain all of the baggage of the society that they come out of. So my society has this bias, therefore I have this bias. So when I make something, I'm often going to be perpetuating and even reinforcing that bias in our society. There are entire fields of media studies that exist to break this stuff apart, analyze this stuff, and most of that is beyond the scope of this talk. But over the last few years, there's been a big push on one specific front, representation. Particularly the representation of women. This has been a major weak spot for games, but I'm glad that we're starting to see some progress in this area. We also need to continue to make progress here by portraying a wider range of different types of people in terms of race, age, gender identity, and other less represented identities in a wider range of roles. The good news on this front is that there isn't any specific conflict between this mission and strategy game design. Like, not to suggest that this is all we have to do, it's not, but it's quite easy to change your straight white male character into a non-white queer female character in a strategy game. There's nothing about a strategy game that should cause a problem there. But there's another social problem in games that does pose an inherent conflict for strategy games, at least in how we understand strategy games today. It's something that I often talk about as simply violence glorification, but really it's a suite of behaviors, themes, and settings which are not only dehumanizing and probably harmful for society, but they're also just not welcoming to a lot of people. Can we make non-violent games that take place in a setting other than a hellish post-apocalypse or a hellish war zone or a hellish medieval wasteland? Absolutely, of course we can, and we do. There have always been non-violent games, and there's always been a conversation about how it's good that we have some non-violent games. But applying that quest to deep strategy games that you can live in is something that too few developers have really tried or succeeded in doing. It's undeniable that among the most successful and able to live in strategy games, most of them are violent, at least in video games. I'm going to talk about why that might be. First off, I'm not talking about violence as in specifically seeing blood and guts or specifically being set in a war zone necessarily. I'm talking about an atmosphere of violence, and I'll go more into detail on this later, but for now just know that I'm using the term violence in a somewhat broad sense here. There's nothing inherent to a system in which I make choices towards a goal, or a contest of decision making as I sometimes call it, that should necessarily force a developer to theme their game in a violent way. There are a lot of games that sort of qualify as strategy games, and which sort of qualify as nonviolent, but most of the most successful strategy-ish video games have almost all been violent. Think about like League of Legends, Team Fortress 2, Civilization, XCOM, StarCraft, so on, roguelikes, the list goes on. Two interesting examples of popular nonviolent games are abstract systems like Dr. Mario or Tetris. I'm not sure that either of these fully qualify as strategy games per se, but both of these have many of the trappings of a strategy game and yet have no clear tie-in to violence or other forms of toxicity. However, they're also both inherently very simple, which puts a hard cap on their depth. Yeah, you can play them for years, but a lot of that is because they're highly random and have very high execution. Which, you know, again, execution is a type of skill, it's a type of mastery, but it is distinct from strategy mastery and strategy depth, strategic depth. These are both fun games and I love them, but they're not deep strategy games. To me, the best examples of nonviolent deep strategy games aren't happening in video games. They're happening in board games. Specifically, the world of designer Euro strategy games, such as the aforementioned Puerto Rico or Agricola, or even Pandemic or Settlers of Catan. These are strong and deep strategy games that aren't violent at all. So maybe that's one path forward for video game developers. Follow in the footsteps of these European designer board games. I should mention off the top here that, you know, these are we could do better than these. Like, Agricola is probably a pretty good example, because Agricola is really just about creating a little farm. There's almost nothing remotely violent or toxic about Agricola. Puerto Rico has, you know, it's like you're colonizing a place. You have these little, like, worker tokens that are brown. And, you know, and Pandemic is like an apocalyptic world where everyone's dying. I mean, that's not great. So we can do maybe better than these. But these are really good, like, starting positions. And they're certainly better than most video games in terms of their general toxicity. The problem is that games like these have to be taught to players. It's not just that board games like can't have this interactive tutorial like a lot of new video games do, or most video games do. Even if they could, these games have verbs that are just entirely new to video game players. So everything about them has to be explicitly taught from the ground up. And this also affects like marketing a game like this. If players look at the board of Agricola and they don't have a framework for understanding what's going on, it's totally alien to them. Compare this really quickly to, say, League of Legends, where we all already know about moving a little guy by clicking him around. We all already know about hit points and what that means. We all already know, at least loosely, about like what an item is, about what a casting a spell is, about attacking things, and so on. Yeah, sure, they don't work the same way in every single game, but we get a pretty good head start on understanding these actions that the player can take. And it's not just about teaching players the rules either. There's like this emotional comfort level that players have with the Dungeons & Dragons kit of interactions. Not only do we sort of already get how attacking a unit works, but we also are already primed to understand and accept the feedback of dealing damage, and perhaps even more important, actor removal, which we'll come back to. In short, you totally can make some designer board game-like highly original thing, and many developers do. But most players are just really not accustomed to having to learn a bunch of systemic rules. Content rules, such as the hundreds of characters, abilities, items, and so on in League of Legends, we're pretty accustomed to having to learn. And players can hop into League or any other similar games before they even lay their hand on the mouse. They know how to move, they know how to use spells, they understand the concepts of health and death and healing and so on. Systemic rules are the rules that players must learn up front before they can do anything resembling playing. The process of learning these kinds of rules is hard. It's like picking up a new language or a new musical instrument. Most people who try to pick up those sorts of things give up early when it's hardest to grasp what's going on at all. Most of us here have probably had the experience of sitting around a table, carefully reading the rule book to some really complex Euro game, feeling just kind of lost for the first 30 to 90 minutes, sometimes more. But we've done that. We've all sat through that because we're here at an indie games conference, or we're here listening to this game design podcast or watching this video. And so we're in the top percentiles of serious about our games. And a lot of people just aren't going to be willing to endure that, especially in the realm of digital games where it's so uncommon to have that feeling of pure bewilderment. I mentioned earlier that strategy games need to be complex in order to create strategic depth. Well, one of the main ways to get around this feeling of pure bewilderment is to use the verbs and nouns and adjectives that players already know, to use that known language established in D&D and wargame customs. The only problem is that that language is one of violence, of domination, of exclusion, and of alienation. At the heart of the modern strategy game is always one core action, which I refer to as actor removal. We all know what this is. In its most basic form, there's something on the screen and you click on it until it goes away. Or maybe you have to do a long series of complicated things to make the thing go away, but ultimately it's all about how there is something and you are destroying it or removing it. I've long had skepticism purely from a formal design perspective of this design pattern, or at least of the idea that it should be so common or automatic or default. Just formally speaking, it seems backwards to me that throughout a match, you're removing actors from play because that's actually removing complexity from the game space. In most games, when an actor is alive, it means so much for the game state. What is the actor doing? Where is he facing or moving? What are his stats and so on? Once he has been removed, now you're just in an empty room. I often think about a classic situation in a first-person shooter where you start out with a bunch of enemies all over the place. This is a rich, complex situation. Then you kill a bunch of enemies, and at some point, it's just a cleanup operation. And then, at some point, you're just alone in a room full of dead bodies. Shooters aren't the best example of strategy games, but this is also true in strategy games like Civilization or Total War. There's a bunch of military units on your border, and at this moment, in this state, there's so much to think about. But then the fight happens, you win, and now your reward is a far less interesting game state. One moment there is life, and the next moment there's nothing. Getting more basic, one could say that in most multiplayer strategy games, the objective is always to reduce the agency of your opponent before defeating them. Subduing them and dominating them is fundamentally the goal of these games. This is certainly the case for war games, but also arguably the case for almost any multiplayer competitive strategy game. So when you couple this idea of removing actors from play with this idea of dominating your opponent, and then on top of that you add in this thematic layer that looks like it was designed to appeal primarily to serial killers, is it any wonder that people are dickheads to each other? I'm a League of Legends fan. I've written before about how I think it's the world's best strategy game overall, just based on the basic Dota premise, plus the incredible level of polish that League has been able to apply. And companies like Blizzard and Riot have been making really strong efforts for years to try to combat their toxicity problem. But this is an uphill battle, an incredibly uphill battle, because these are games that are fundamentally about dominating other human beings, and they express this in the most toxic and dehumanizing ways possible. When people think about toxicity in games, they usually only think about what players type in chat to one another. But what if that's really only the tip of the iceberg? What if the entire game just makes people feel more isolated, more alone, less likely to want to cooperate, less likely to want to try and understand, feeling like my only option here is to dominate or else I will be dominated? League of Legends and a bunch of other games out there, they are games that you could live in, and millions do. But at what cost? These are the kinds of games that often feel like anti-social, anti-compassion simulators. Do we really want to live in such a hostile environment? Is there any reason that we have to? So here's a breakdown of the problem in review. One, strategy games need to be quite complicated in order to have true strategic depth and not rely on randomness or execution to create variant outcomes or avoid being solved. Two, to express this complex system in a way that feels comfortable and not bewildering to players, you probably have to, at least to some extent, use the existing language of such games. And three, the existing language of such games is violence, or at least about domination, exclusion, and usually themes that are kind of hostile. I personally haven't found the perfect answer to this problem exactly. My current opinion is that you maybe just have to split the difference on all three steps and just kind of do the best you can at each level. I'm working on two single-player strategy games right now. In one of them, Push the Lane, you have attacks and hit points and actor removal, as it's loosely based on games like League of Legends. But I tried to at least make it so that the enemies are non-human and just weird stuff like potatoes and other vegetables and that you're fighting and this weird triangle monster thing. So this, coupled with the abstract lo-fi visuals and animations, hopefully at least reduces the overall toxic, gross serial killer feeling that a lot of these strategy games have, as well as it being single player, which I will get back to. In another game I'm working on, it's a kind of like a Dr. Mario, but you drop bombs on fruit to make jelly. It's mostly just silly, but maybe there's a super subtle message here that, hey, this is a world where, sure, yeah, we have bombs and guns and stuff, but we only use those things to make yummy jam. And that, you know, that kind of seems like an okay world to live in. I'd like to quickly also give a shout out to Happy Snake Games, who is, you know, actually was a big inspiration for a lot of this kind of stuff for me. They are making these extremely cute, extremely non-toxic games, but they're also working on making strategy game systems. And so definitely check them out if you are not aware of them already. There are certainly other languages that exist which you can, to some extent, use. A lot of people bring up sports games, and these can work. Although the further you stray from just being fundamentally like football, for example, the less a football theme is doing for you. And to be honest, most sports are far too simple to function without all the execution and randomness that they have. There are other examples, like economic games and political games, but these have similar problems to the farming Eurogame designs. Players just don't already know what the verbs are in a political game, so you're not getting free information the way that you would with a war theme. But with that said, I do think that these and other areas are certainly players' desires should look for solutions. Earlier, I mentioned that Eurogames, which I consider to be some of the best examples of the strong, complex strategy games that I'm looking for, which are also nonviolent, often get called multiplayer solitaire. And this is because in many of the games, you almost never interact with the other players. Maybe you take a wheat resource here and there that another player wanted, and sometimes it does matter a lot. Eurogame fans definitely like to argue that they're very interactive, but all I'll say is that there's a reason that this epithet gets thrown at the games. Part of the reason may be that we're not punching each other in the face and we're not directly, attacking each other. And that's why people are calling them single multiplayer solitaire. But I also think that, these games also, they tend to come with the single player mode. It doesn't take a lot of rule changes to turn them single player. A lot of them are just race to victory points, that kind of thing. So, unfortunately, a person playing a physical board game single player is just the saddest thing in the world. As an extra feature, it's cool to have, but you just can't sell a game that way. You can't sell a single player board game, really. However, video games absolutely can be single player, and there's a ton of advantages to making video games single player. And from my perspective, strategy games just don't need multiple players. We're used to it, and we sort of inherently think of classic stuff like chess and Go when we think of such things, but maybe one solution is to start trying to break that pattern. Maybe the default number of players should actually be one. So here's a quick summary of some points for making single player strategy games. You don't have to worry about, stuff like netcode or server costs. Your game is still playable, even if you're the only player. We all know about this concept where that was a great multiplayer game, but now no one plays it. So I can't play it because no one else is playing it. That doesn't happen with single player. Specific control over the kind of randomness coming into the system. This is a big one. So in a single player game, you, the designer, has very specific control over what kind of randomness is coming into the system. So you don't have to worry about another player doing the equivalent of playing paper 300 times in a row or wandering out into an obviously unsafe area and making a really dumb freak move that sort of throws the whole match's validity into question. You have explicit control over what kinds of challenges your player is going to face at every point. But the bigger thing is that the fact that no matter how nonviolent you theme your game, it still feels kind of bad to create some system that's going to rank or sort you and your friend, or you and a stranger, into two categories, the winner and the loser. When you win, there's this sort of lonely feeling of being alone in that room with a bunch of dead bodies. And when you lose, we all know that that sucks. We can't get rid of winning and losing without getting rid of the basic idea of the strategy game. You must have a distinct, clear goal in order to have a strategy that either leads to that goal or doesn't. But we can get rid of the social sorting aspect of strategy games, and so I think we probably should at least consider it. The player does not need to know if they're better than another person. They just need to know if they're getting better relative to themselves. By the way, this is why I created Oro's single-player ELO system, which increases and decreases the player's rank and the game's difficulty in order to demonstrate to the player whether or not they're improving. I advocate this model for single-player strategy games, and you can look up some details about this on Dino Farm's website at dinofarmgames.com. Developers have been working for years on finding ways to make single-player experiences more social. In the old days, you just had leaderboards, but today we have a ton of different interesting possibilities, from stuff like daily challenges, sharing screenshots and other things on social media. My main concern with this talk is how do we make games less antisocial? That's what I've been talking about so far. And while making games single player may actually help with that, maybe these kinds of innovative features can actually make them more positively social, more proactively social. Another good route for making single player games social is to make cooperative games. It's true that cooperative games are often just a single player game by committee, wherein one player is calling all the shots, but honestly, maybe that's not such a big problem. I mean, if you and your friend have wildly different skill levels at any game, you're not going to have a great one-on-one competitive match either. There are some solutions to this problem. But even without those problems fixed, I think pretty much everyone agrees that Pandemic is really great. I've noticed here at IndieCade, which is pleasingly inclusive and social justice oriented, that it strays a lot from the traditional language of strategy games, violence. There are very few violent games about actor removal here. But I also haven't noticed many games which I would call strategy games here either. And my hope is that we don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I should also say, though, that if it did turn out that actually violence and dehumanization of some kinds are intrinsically linked to the form of the strategy game, in that case, I would say that they're not worth it. In that case, I would stop making strategy games. But I don't think that's the case. I want to create deep, strong, single-player strategy games that are as inclusive as possible, as non-toxic as possible, while being easy as possible for video game players to hook onto and understand. I want to find ways to make them not only not antisocial, but proactively social, despite the fact that they're single player. It's a challenge, and I think I'm going to fail to some extent, but I'm going to try, and I hope that some of you will too, because that's the kind of game that I want to live in.
This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun.